God idea is something that we cannot get rid of. There may be skeptics, there may be agnostics who say there's no God and so on and so forth. But we know those who have been agnostics and skeptics have at some time in their life have come to feel that they were wrong and there is something, some superior power or something which is behind all this marvelous complex universe. So everyone feels it. Everyone has that feeling. But what that supreme cause or power, which generally people call God, what that is, opinions vary and beliefs vary from people to people, from individual to individual. But it is there. A very nice statement in the ISIS Unveiled, I don't remember the page number, on this contest between some of the absurd ideas about God and total denial of God by agnostic science, and on the other side, some idea about God which flies against reason. Between these two is a bewildered public. It says, one, that is, the theologian thunders, there is a personal God, there is a personal devil, and he who denies it is doomed, is damned. But the other side answers, there is no such personal God or personal devil. It is all your mumbo jumbo, it is all your brain. It is a work of your, it has no existence apart from your brain. So all that exists because of laws of the material and mechanical universe. There is no such thing known as God. So one says that. And between these two is the helpless public. That's very nicely brought out. ISIS Unveiled. Fast losing its intuitive feeling of immortality of some kind, God in nature, and drifting into some kind of agnosticism and helplessness and cut off from reality, drifting away. And in the great work ISIS Unveiled, this sorry state of affairs is the author tries to remedy by challenging both this theology and science, and telling theology your conception of God is the reason why a materialism has arisen which denies God, because your conceptions are so absurd and so illogical that no human reason can ever accept. And naturally, there is a reaction against your dogmas. And materialism is a result. And after having said that, she challenges both these groups, both these opposing camps, and say, occultists, the theosophist or the true philosophers only can give the right idea of what deity or God is, which reconciles true religion and true science, and show and demonstrate both of them to be mutually complementary. So there is a beauty of theosophy. Now, we know, you have to only look around and see how magnificent the whole universe is in its harmonious order, regularity, rhythm, intelligent processes. These undeniable intelligent processes. Throughout the 19th century and 18th century, Western science has denied any such intelligence. But they cannot close their eyes to a fact which is too very patent and very evident, even to the dullest mind. If you examine your own body, what a marvelous, intelligent design is there in the whole process. And similarly, if you, even if you look at a cell and the DNA structures and all that, and how proteins are made, and through this, you know, memory in the DNA and how it is replicated according to the needs of the body, how proteins are made. It is amazing. If you take just one eye, organ of sight, the intricacies of it, if you view, then it is only some sort of a diseased mind can only say there is no intelligent design there. Is it not? And look at the macrocosmic world. This earth has been revolving on its own axis and going around the sun, and the moon has been going around the earth, and all this together producing seasons and lunar months and solar years. And this is not even one hair's breadth of deviation through the whole thing. It's perfect symmetry, regularity, rhythmical. Who can say there's no intelligent design here? So there is. So now, off late, science is modifying its agnosticism. And very intuitive scientists are arguing, I think we have been wrong in denying intelligent design. There is intelligent design. So there is a theory now, intelligent design in science. It is not something new. It is just coming back to their senses after having denied it for 200 years, now coming back to their senses and recognizing there is some intelligent design, and about which ancients have worked up to its highest perfection. So, there is intelligent, creative, lawful something which causes the whole universe to come into being, remain in existence, and go out of existence, and again coming in, again is reborn. So, what can that be? Now, there's another idea that you can consider. It's not that as the Western Orientalists who translated the Rig Veda say, is all the lispings of humanity, infant humanity. They saw the great nature, they were so scared, and then said they invented a god of fire, a god of lightning and all that. So it's all imagination of infant humanity. It's all wrong. The outcome of the materialism of the age. So you must remember, man is a spiritual being. The fact of man being a spiritual being, the blindness of this fact has led to materialism. So, what Theosophy says is there's distinct three evolutionary processes taking place, not purely physical, in which the crown of that physical evolutionary process is the body of man. And there's purely a spiritual evolution. When physical evolution is going on to produce the perfect human form, on the higher planes in the celestial realm, the spirit is descending pari passu, lower end, to meet the physical. So when the both meet, but the both cannot meet, spirit is too pure and physical is too gross. So there is one connecting link is required, and that is the third stream of evolution, manasika intellectual, which connects it. So the physical part of evolution is, the bodily evolution is not the man, it is his instrument, it is his temple, it is his a very complex, beautiful model, archetypal model of the universe. It is not that archetypal model, he has made this, the temple of the living God. It is ready. Only God has to descend and occupy it, but he cannot do it directly. That God is descending as a spirit, deeper and deeper into matter. And now, he cannot descend anything more, so you require a connecting link, which is the link of mind. And that's where, again, that mind is part of the universal mind. So spirit and mind descend gradually. And mind gives a connecting link between the animal below and the God above. Mind becomes the... When this connection takes place, the spiritual man becomes aware of his animal nature. At the same time, because of manasik consciousness, self-consciousness, he is aware of his divinity. So he at once feels himself one with the universe, one with his progenitors, and at the same time is conscious of his divinity. I'm very sorry, I forgot to note on that page number. That's a very beautiful passage. Let's read it. I think if you see the second volume contents, we'll be able to find it. Contents. Nature of All. 263, Symbolism of Kronos, Promethean. No, not this. 263, Nature of the Fall, 267, remember that, 267, it's a very beautiful passage. Then there was no religion, because man knew that he was none other than Brahma. He was wise, full of knowledge. He didn't have any. No religion at all. So, man has always been a spiritual being. When he came on earth to take up the body, he made connection with the material forms in order to, for a great purpose. He as a monastic being is a highly evolved being. He has gone through all the lower kingdoms of nature as a spiritual entity. Now, he has made contact with the body in order to help all other kingdoms of nature below him to be raised up. And he himself has to evolve still to greater heights. So it's for that purpose we have come down here. And when we have come down and contacted the body, we were divine. So, let's try, I hope. Got it right? Yeah, I think so. So this coming of descent of spiritual man into matter and contacting matter and getting embedded in it and forgetting itself. So it is beautifully said in the mythology as the fall of the angel. See, this happens during the third root race. We are in the fifth root race. The third root race was preeminently the bright shadow at first of the gods, whom tradition exiles on earth after the allegorical war in heaven, which became still more allegorical on earth, for it was the war between spirit and matter. No. This is not the... I should have made a note of it. Got it. What was the religion of the third root race? and the early part of the Atlantean race, fourth race. In the common acceptation of the term, neither the Lemurians, that is third root race, nor their progeny, the Lemuro-Atlanteans, they didn't have any religion, as they knew no dogma, nor had they to believe on faith. No sooner had the mental eye of man been opened to understanding, than the third root race felt itself one with the ever-present, as the ever-to-be-unknown, invisible all. The one universal deity, endowed with divine powers, and feeling in himself his inner God. And each felt he was a man-god in his nature, though an animal in his physical self. So man was complete. Now comes the struggle between the spiritual and the material. So the Mahabharata war begins here, right? The struggle between the two began from the time they tasted of the fruit of the tree of wisdom. So it's only in human body and manas that the spiritual man can encompass the whole of the universe, material, psychic, spiritual, whole of the universe. Without body and manasic principle, it becomes pure spirit there. But without spirit, mere animal. But spirit and matter combined together with manas, the whole universe is encompassed. So we are that. So we have passed through that stage. So the struggle between the two began from the very day they tasted the fruit of tree of wisdom. We tasted the fruit of wisdom. We plucked the tree of fruit from the tree of life and tasted it. And what did we make of it? It says here, a struggle for life between the spiritual and the psychic on the one hand, and the psychic and the physical on the other began. Those who conquered the lower principles by obtaining mastery over the body joined the sons of light. Those who fell victims to their lower natures became the slaves of matter and passions. From sons of light and wisdom, they ended by becoming sons of darkness. They had fallen in the battle for mortal life with life immortal. And all those so fallen became the seed of the future generations of Atlanteans. So, page 2, oh, again I forgot, 270. We'll take it later. 272. So, then we lost touch with the spirit, and then intellectual development took place and became slaves of senses and desires and passions. And the third eye, the eye of Shiva, which is all latent in us, it has become, nature has, it was previously in the back of the head. And secret doctrine says, nature carefully brought it to the third ventricle of the brain. The voice of the cell speaks of it as merge into one sense thy senses. Merge into one sense thy senses, which
thou wouldst be secure against the poor.
If thou wouldst secure against the poor. Merge into one sense thy senses within the hollow of thy brain. Within the hollow of the brain. In the third ventricle, there's a hollow, and there, nature has carefully preserved that organ. Science doesn't know what it is. The eye of Shiva. And it is there. When we retrace our steps and reclaim our divine heritage and align ourselves with our true nature and self and conquer and put karma in its place, make it our slave, slave of the divine, then it begins to open. So that is our great goal now. So now we have fallen angels, fallen gods, forgotten over the a very nice allegory in Old Testament and New Testament. It is the parable of the prodigal son. We know that parable of the prodigal son. Now, who is this prodigal son? He is a prince. His parents are divine. This prince is Manas. And king and queen are Atmabuddhi. He is Manas. This Manas has incarnated in working through its lower reflection. And lower reflection has lost its parental origin, become caught up in karma. So that's our situation. So we are strayed from the palace of our divine royal parents and come into material realm, like the prodigal son has strayed from the palace of his royal parents and strayed into, you know, he lives in stables and pigsty and cow shed amidst the filth of the dung and urine, and thinks that that's his place, that's his abode, and all the struggle to exist there, you know, that we are struggling here to exist. It goes on. One day he realizes, somebody comes and tells, why are you struggling for this filthy life? You're not, you belong there. And then, you know, many such great teachers come and remind us, but very few here, some few here, and then, oh, is it so? Then they will begin to search, and then retrace their steps and reclaim their divinity. So this is evolution of God idea. Now, what are the various ideas of God that we have? Theologians, as I already said, you know, they say there is an outside God and an outside Satan, right? And man is a helpless pawn between these two. The God is outside and Satan is outside. There are two contrary anthropomorphic creatures, and man is a helpless pawn in their hands. So there's a kind of, you know, idea that the Christian church projects. There's a passage in the Kirti Theosophy which gives an idea of God of Christians. It says, Presbyterian faith, their idea of God is, there is a God who creates the world, who has made human beings. So by his inscrutable will, and nobody can question why he does it, one section of humanity he has made his chosen people, and to them only is salvation is possible. The other section of mankind, nobody knows why he has made, he has condemned forever to be, he has condemned them to be in hell always. There is no salvation for them. Only to the chosen few he has sent, you know, their God, Jesus Christ, to save. What kind of a God is he? Even a worst of criminal among human beings seems better than such a God. This is the reason why there is, you know, so much of materialism in the West. They rejected, they hate this religion and theosophy, which has plunged them into this kind of an idiocy for 1,500 years. So as a strong reaction, this materialism and agnosticism has developed in the West. So this is a kind of, you know, one idea of God. But whereas the Oriental wisdom has always been saying that God cannot be any being, it cannot be any creator. So it postulates an absolute causeless cause, infinite, eternal, boundless, from which everything comes, in which everything exists, into which everything resolves, to be born again, coming out. So this absolute or infinite, eternal, boundless cannot be called a being. It is absolute life. In that absolute life, conditioned life incessantly arises and again resolves back into it. It arises again and goes back into it again. So it's regular succession of coming out, evolving, resolving back, again coming out, like we wake in the night, we sleep in the night and wake in the morning, and again we go to sleep. So the universe arises, Brahma wakes into activity, and then he evolves the whole universe, and then everything is resolved back, and there's the light of Brahma, equal to the duration. So this is very beautifully brought out in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 8th chapter. So, who is the creator? Nobody creates, it's law. It is law. So, what does Krishna teach about the idea of God here? Those who are acquainted with the day and night know that the day of Brahma is 1,000 revolutions of the yugas, and that his night extended for 1,000 more. At the coming on of that day, all things issue forth from the unmanifested into manifestation. So on the approach of that night, they merge again into the unmanifested. This collection of existing things, having thus come forth, is dissolved at the approach of the night, Vastana Prita. And now again, on the coming on of the day, it emanates spontaneously. Nobody makes, nobody creates. But there is that which upon the dissolution of all things else is not destroyed. It is indivisible, indestructible, and of another nature than the visible. That called the unmanifested and exhaustless is called the supreme goal, which having once attained, they nevermore return. It is my supreme abode. This supreme O Son of Prita, within whom all creatures are included, and by whom all this is pervaded, may be attained by a devotion which is intending on him alone. This is the God idea of the Oriental philosophy. So if it is all-pervading divinity, then how can you say it is absent from any creature? Anyone, good or bad or indifferent, how can it be absent from a single atom? So the inmost essence of every being is that supreme life or spirit or deity. And the deity itself becomes all this and yet remains separate. So, what does it mean? Where do we have to look for the deity? We can look for the deity only within us, our inmost essence, in the depth of our own consciousness, in the depth of our own heart consciousness. It can be found. There's nowhere else. All that we can know of God is within ourselves, by ourselves, through ourselves. Similarly, with every other creature, the God seated in the heart of every being is the very same God, as beautifully said in the 13th chapter we read. As a single sun illuminates the whole world, so does one spirit illuminate all bodies. So the self in you, the true self in you, the true self in him, the true self in the donkey, ass, or the ant, the atom, the highest Dhyanibuddha, or in Infusoria, it's the same self, the same supreme self. So this is the God idea that we have to realize it. How do we realize it? So, how do we realize this God idea? We realize this God idea, and the whole purpose of life is realize this, realization of it. We are going through this life experiences, and the whole universal evolutionary march to which everything is subject is heading towards the great end of all beings come to realization of its self and essence to be none other than the universal divine self. Their progressive march towards higher. It is through life's experiences that we and in this life's experiences, as we are part of that supreme harmony and justice, in the yesterday's study class we were reading, Once you postulate an absolute, how can you deny infinitude and absolute as the ultimate cause, this cause of all that was, is, and will be? How can you deny it? It is self-evident. So then, all beings essentially being one, in manifestation we see difference because of our limitation of senses. That does not do away with the fact that the reality is one. And therefore, there is absolute, there should be in the very heart of life absolute harmony, which means justice, which means our inmost essence is, there is justice in our inmost essence, there is harmony in our depths of our being. So when we begin to act unaware of our inmost depth of harmony and justice, and forgetting that and coming into the illusion of separateness, and we act selfishly, we there and then instantly violating that harmony which is our own, you know, essence of our being, and feel the reaction coming to us as pain, suffering, sorrow, individually and collectively. That's the reason why we all suffer so much. And the suffering itself, you know, continuous beating that we get in life, disappointment, sorrows, miseries, at last makes the soul so, it softens the soul and begins to really make inquiries. Why? Begins to search. As Krishna says, there are four kinds of beings who worship Krishna. There is those who are afflicted, those who are desired possessions, and what is the third one? Those who are afflicted, those who desire possessions, and lastly, those who are wise. So it's affliction which make one really search. And from the time, you know, we get afflicted, we begin to search, to the final reaching of the object of our search, it may be ages, but the search has begun. So one has to look within oneself. And what the teacher says, to aid this whole process, the great teachers come. So there is naturally, you know, there is an outward path, pravritti. It is natural, you know, for man to look outward and seek fulfillment of his aspirations outside. It is natural for him at this stage of evolution, pravritti marga. So the great teachers recognize this. So they have said, look, this is natural for you to fulfill your desire. Go ahead and do it, but remember, there are immutable laws of life. And laws of virtue. In your search for pleasure, don't ever lose your firm, foundation in loss of virtue. Fulfill your desires. Have your objects of material things. Go ahead. But let it be according to the immutable laws of virtue. If you deviate from the laws of virtue, then you will come to great sorrow and suffering. So that's why Krishna says, this fulfillment of our objects of desire in the world in accordance with the laws of virtue, he calls it as, he says in such a case he's there, Krishna is there. I am desire regulated by moral fitness. Regulated by moral fitness. So if you follow this path of living a life prescribed by the Dharma Shastras as a holy writ and never deviate from it, then our actions will be within the law of spiritual continuity, in the sense that the end of our life, there is something always surviving and become a permanent part of our higher, immortal, divine self. And then this accumulation of experience from every life, you know, the most spiritual part of it, it accumulates in our higher real nature. And the egoic progress through many ages like this will ultimately bring about so much of experience and so much of accumulation of virtue. Then there's a desire will arise in us for real knowledge. And then one begins to go deep into the teachings of the great ones, and a longing for true realization of reality and the self begins to arise. Then he begins to hold, as he studies the philosophy, then he begins to see, get rid of this idea of separateness, and more the unity of self and universal brotherhood he begins to come to see, and the universal harmony, justice, and recognition of law, that he is responsible for his own acts, and every circumstance of life, good or bad, could never come to him which he has not produced the cause of it, and similarly take the responsibility for the ills of society, and his whole desire will be less and less of the personal and more of loka sangraha, or good of the world. And he begins to realize that the real self, the Atman, is incomprehensible. It is unattainable. It is unreachable. That can be known and realized in only one way. There is total identification of self with entire humanity. So his whole object will be then service of humanity. That's why our ULT Lodge says that, service of humanity. So that is, you know, the evolution of God idea to the time that we actually attain to the, who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. Service of humanity without distinction of caste, creed. Then he'll, a stage will come when he utterly loses his self-interest and entirely becomes devoted to humanity. And ultimately the self merges into the great self. You know, I made a note of this. This progression is beautifully brought out in the Bhagavata Purana as Navavida Bhakti. Navavida Bhakti. Now we have a excellent book called the Lectures in the Bhagavad Gita by Pandit Bhavani Shankar. He was not an ordinary teacher. He was a disciple of the masters. So, the high chila. He gave a series of lectures. He lectured in ULT Bombay also. Some of his lectures have been recorded and brought out. You must read that. There are 9 stages of evolution of God idea. Shravana. What we do here, Shravana. Shravana is hearing the sacred signs. And then Kirtana. Kirtana means, it is not, singing is one. You know, we gather here week after week, talk about this, and then we recall the fundamental propositions. We read the devotional book, dwell upon it. Kirtana. Right? And then Smarana. Not only to brooding over it, exemplification, brooding over it. You know, when you are shaving, when you are taking bath, when you are doing so many things, you are brooding over it. You are performing your duties, you are performing your duties with that higher perspective. You are performing your duties, right? As he quotes B.P. Wadia was saying, every duty that we have to perform is a step we take, but our whole perspective is, heart is on the great goal. You know, that kind of a, it is a smarana, brooding over it. And then a stage comes, padasevana, when you lose, you know, vairagya takes such a deep root in you that you care nothing for yourself and do only the bidding of the higher self, bidding of the master. So that is beautifully recorded here, you know. Professing loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, the great gurus, to the theosophical cause, all organization, everything is lost sight of. Your own personal care is padasevanam, your service of the cause of the masters, right, for humanity's sake. Then that's padasevanam. And then archana, the fifth development is archana, in which deep meditation disciple enters into and forgets himself in the deep meditation. And then vandanam. Vandanam is, he sees divinity everywhere. In the Bhagavata Purana, Krishna says to Uddhava, you must be so forgetful that you will be prostrating before everything, prostrating before a donkey, prostrating before a mlecha, prostrating before a chandala, prostrating before a brahmana. Because you see divinity everywhere. You know, that kind of a thing, vandanam. And then comes dasya. Dasya. There is a servant master. Dasya to such an extent, that is beautifully exemplified in HBB's life. When the word comes to master, do it, instantly she will do it. That may bring calamity on her head. Doesn't matter at all. There's another episode in Shankaracharya's, when his favorite disciple, what's his, Padmapada, he gets the pain of Padmapada. He's on the other side of the lake. Guru is here. He calls him. Instantly he moves on the water. He may get drowned. He doesn't care at all if he drowns. And then for every step that he takes, a lotus is materialized. And then it comes to the Guru. So when a word comes to higher self and Guru, therein then he obeys it. Dasya. That is a very high stage of devotion. And then Satyata, friendship. And in this, that's what Krishna says. You know, Krishna, Arjuna had attained to that Satyata stage in the fourth chapter. In the fourth chapter he says, you are my friend and my devotee, Sakya and Sakha, Bhakta and Sakha. It is even the same exhaustless, secret, eternal doctrine I have this day communicated unto thee, because thou art my devotee and my friend. Only when we reach that stage of Sakyata and Bhakta, that true knowledge can be passed on by the teacher. And there, the more of the divine and less of the servant is there in the perspective of the Bhakta. And then comes Atmanivedana, when Bhakta entirely merges in divinity. And as voice of the silence says, the spark has become the fire. The ray becomes the eternal radiance. Drop has merged in the ocean. Atmanivedana. So the evolution of Godhead. So there are some few thoughts. Take more time than necessary. So we can talk about this.